Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we're now taking entries in our Uncommon Economic Indicators video contest. We want your short videos showing an uncommon economic indicator in your neighborhood. The best couple of videos will get a screening before a live audience at WNYC's Jerome L. Green Performance Space, and our grand prize winner will get a screening at a rooftop films event in Brooklyn. The deadline is June 21st. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show to see how to enter the first ever Uncommon Economic Indicators video contest. Noam Chomsky is my next guest. The occasion is the 40th anniversary of his seminal book, American Power and the New Mandarins, which moved Chomsky from world-renowned linguist and a founder of cognitive psychology to also world-renowned political commentator. Dr. Chomsky will be speaking Friday night at Manhattan's Riverside Church in conjunction with the book's 40th anniversary, a benefit for the Brecht Forum, the political and cultural center in the West Village. Dr. Chomsky, hello. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good to be here.
Take us back. American Power and the New Mandarins. The New Mandarins were a class of largely liberal intellectuals who you believed were giving President Johnson intellectual cover for an imperialist war in Vietnam?
Actually, primarily Kennedy. The group that became famous as the action intellectuals, the technocratic elite, as they called themselves.
What Kennedy referred to as the best and the brightest?
I don't know if he used that word, but yes, that's what they were called. And then they stayed on, sort of began to drift away through the Johnson administration, but they remained effective, and they remain so today. I mean, the same groups, often the same people, are still influential, and they still regard themselves that way. So, for example, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who's very much alive and active, is one of those who touted the technocratic elite back in the 1960s. I suspect he must have been discussed in the book.
Looking at Kennedy and looking at LBJ, do you believe that they agonized over Vietnam? Other histories say, you know, they were more interested, LBJ was more interested in great society, domestic legislation, but felt that he had to stop the military march of communism. Or was there more of a clear agenda, as you see it, to spread American power around the world for its own sake?
Well, I agree with you about Johnson. I think he would have been very pleased to be able to focus on his domestic agenda, which was, we should remember, oppressed by the activist popular movements that were taking shape and becoming quite effective through the 1960s. And like most government progressive policies, he was riding on that wave. And he would have liked to focus on that. Stopping the march of communism is a kind of a strange phrase. There was no march of communism. Back in the 1940s, when the United States had to make the decision whether to back France's effort to reconquer its Indochina colonies or else to support the independence movement, as it did in some other places like Indonesia, it was well understood that the Viet Minh, you know, Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh were simply the nationalist movement of Indochina. That was understood all the way through. So right in the Kennedy years, the leading U.S. government scholar, Douglas Pike, wrote a major book called Viet Cong, as they were then called. He simply described them as the only mass-based political party in South Vietnam. He said to try to deal with them in the political arena would be like a minnow dealing with a whale. And if you look back now, we have a lot more evidence from declassified documents and province memoirs.
So if Kennedy understood that in that way, what do you think he was after in Vietnam?
Well, if you look back at the records, and in fact I wrote about it as soon as the Pentagon Papers came out, there's a lot of documentation, and since then it's been much enriched. But there was a concern with what's called the domino theory, and that actually has two versions. There's a version for the public and an internal version. The version for the public is, Ho Chi Minh is going to get into a canoe and come over and, rape your grandmother or something like that.
It was really the Soviets and the Chinese. Country by country, the dominoes would fall if we allowed them, correct?
The Soviets and the Chinese were practically at war by the time Kennedy got involved, and they had very little to do with Indochina. It was a nationalist movement. It was understood. But the concern, there's a serious version of the domino theory, which is held internally, and not just in this case. In case after case, it's the leading motif in forceful intervention, case after case. It's what Dean Acheson called a rotten apple that might spoil the barrel. Or Arthur Schlesinger back in the early 60s when Kennedy was coming in and he headed the Latin American mission, he warned that in the case of Cuba, what he warned about is what he called the spread of the Castro idea of taking matters into your own hands, which may encourage others in the region who suffer similar problems. They'll do the same, and our system of domination will erode. In the case of Indochina, it was pretty straightforward. They were concerned that a national movement in Vietnam, maybe, whatever it was internally, might be economically successful and socially successful in terms that would appeal to others in the region, Thailand, Indonesia, which was a big concern. Eisenhower, in fact, had carried out a major intervention in 1958 to try to overthrow the government of Indonesia, which was kind of falling out of control. And unlike Vietnam, Indonesia has very rich resources. So those are the dominoes that might topple. And then there's what the leading Asia historian John Dower called the super domino, Japan. If country after country started moving in an independent nationalist direction, Japan, the super domino, might decide that it wanted to, as it was called, accommodate itself to an independent Southeast Asia, in which case, and become its technological industrial center, which would pretty much mean that the United States would have lost the Pacific phase of the Second World War. That was what Japan was trying to do, and the U.S. wanted to stop it. And in the 1950s and the early 60s, planners were not ready to lose the Second World War. That's a constant theme. It was the reason for overthrowing the Allende regime, as Kissinger put it.
When you say the Second World War, you mean the Cold War?
No, no, I mean the Second World War. The Pacific phase of the Second World War, the big issue was Japan's effort to construct what they called a new order in Asia, which would drive out the Europeans and the Americans.
Right.
Were
so it could have happened by other means, you're saying?
It could have happened. Yeah, that's the domino theory.
Late as the 50s.
As I say, it's over and over.
Yeah.
So take, say, Cuba's a case in point where it's very explicit in the record. Take Chile. Kissinger's version of it was that he said Allende could be a virus that might spread contagion as far as southern Europe.
The socialist elected president, yes.
Well, just a parliamentary regime moving in a social democratic direction. We don't want that. In fact, Brezhnev agreed with him. The two of them were concerned about the same spread.
Let me bring it to the present for our remaining few minutes. What do you think of Obama through your lens of new mandarins? He's appointed his own class of Ivy League liberal intellectuals. Of course, the times are very different, but how similar, how different in terms of the expression of American power, in your opinion?
The spectrum is pretty narrow. Whether you're talking about the technocratic elite of liberal intellectuals or the Straussian neocons, they share some fundamental ideas. One idea that they share is that the public has to be kept out of influencing policy. These are elite decisions made by small groups who call themselves, you know, the responsible men or the experts or something like that. And you got to make sure the public doesn't interfere with them. That's a very standard theme. In fact, it goes down and goes back to James Madison and the framing of the Constitution. And they also think that it's their task at the helm is to ensure that what are called U.S. interests, which means the interests of the state corporate sector and those who dominate it, will be able to flourish around the world, which constantly means preventing dominoes from falling, preventing independent nationalist forces from breaking out of control. Now, sometime during the Cold War, it was indeed associated with the Soviet Union and China, but it's done in a pretty comical way. Actually, there's a wonderful book about it now by James Peck, called the very good China scholar, called Washington's China. It's the first book to go through carefully the national security culture, the declassified documentary record of the National Security Council and those around it. And it's very similar all the way through, from, you know, from the 40s up until Nixon, when the record runs dry. They had a conclusion. The conclusion was, China's an evil force. We got to stop them. And then they shifted the argument, so depending on the circumstances, so as to lead to that conclusion. And it's put in terms that sound almost manic. So just to give you an example, in the case of Vietnam, back when the U.S. decided to support France, 1950, U.S. intelligence was assigned a task. The task was to prove that Ho Chi Minh was a puppet of either Russia or China or the Sino-Soviet conspiracy. It didn't really matter whom, just a puppet of one of them. And they worked hard on it. You look through the internal record, you see a very extensive effort to try to prove it. And finally, the U.S. intelligence came up with the conclusion that it's very odd, but the Viet Minh seem to be the only group in Southeast Asia that doesn't seem to have contact with either China or Russia.
Dr. Chomsky, we have about 2 minutes left. I'm curious what you think now your impact has been after 40 years of commenting on American power. Have you had an impact on policy or just on those who read you and listen to you from the outside?
Well, the latter is what I would hope. It's for others to judge. But I'm not talking to policymakers. They know what they're doing. I don't have to explain anything to them. I think the public should know and act on that knowledge and act to influence policy. And I think, you know, not me, but that's what happened. The activism of the 60s has had a very substantial effect in civilizing the society. The 60s and the aftermath, because it never stopped. And there are a lot of people who participated in that. I'm, you know, happy to have been able to be one of them, but there are plenty. And they've just changed the country. I mean, let's say take the last election. I mean, I don't happen to like any of the candidates, but the very fact that the Democrats had a woman and an African-American as candidates, it would have been unthinkable in the 1960s, or for that matter, the 1980s. These are just aspects of the process of becoming more civilized
in a lot of respects. Give me a minute on your impressions of Obama, the most important ones.
Well, there was an article by Flint and Hillary Leverett, Iran specialists in the New York Times, a couple of weeks ago, in which they described Obama's policies as a prettified Bush. I think that's fairly accurate. I mean, he's pulled back from the more extreme, some of the more extreme stands of the Bush administration, which were really off the spectrum, and back more towards a normal centrist Democrat. But a lot of the rest is warmed over Bush. So, for example, the speech in Cairo the other day.
Yeah, we have 15 seconds. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, if you put aside the style, which was different, the content Bush could have said.
The views of Noam Chomsky on the 40th anniversary of the publication of his book, American Power and the New Mandarins. He will be speaking at the Riverside Church this Friday night at an event that begins at 6 o'clock, being sponsored by the Mission of Social Justice and Education at the church to benefit the Brecht Forum Cultural Center. For tickets, if you're interested, you can go to brechtforum.org or call 212-242-4201. Noam Chomsky, thank you very much.
Glad to be with you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.